The Golden Age of Radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the Golden Age of Radio, The Fight Against Fire on Adventures and Research, final moments of the 1942 Major League Baseball All-Star Game, and the true story of the checkered life and sudden death of James Fisk on Crime Classics. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, the final moments of the 1942 Major League Baseball All-Star Game before a scheduled blackout in New York City during World War II, and the true story of the checkered life and sudden death of James Fisk on Crime Classics. Right now, The Fight Against Fire on Adventures and Research, featuring narrator Paul Shannon, as WMKY presents The Golden Age of Radio.
Adventures in Research. One of the most familiar sounds of modern civilization is this. But the signal warning of a fire did not always sound like that. Originally, the fire alarm sounded down the streets like this. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. And today telling you the story of fire and the men who fought it. Fought it in the days before machines or engines or even horses. Before the white man came to America, there were fires, of course. But they posed no problem to the Indian. If he rubbed two sticks together and couldn't control the result of his labors. The village merely picked up its portable dwellings and fled the fires to a greener part of the land. But with the arrival of white men and the formation of cities, this method wasn't so easy.
Quite some house Mr. Stewart's building, huh?
Yeah, no doubt about it. Gonna be the biggest house in all New Amsterdam.
Yeah?
My, look at the work they're putting into it.
Isn't he? Took a lot of lumber, all right.
Well, one thing we got here is trees aplenty.
Yes, isn't he? A couple trees alone went into that chimney.
Yep, as nice a wood chimney as you'll see in the whole town.
And a nice thatched roof. Yeah, Mr. Stewart's going to be mighty comfortable with a nice house like that.
Wooden chimneys, thatched roofs, a pretty inflammable combination in New Amsterdam. And if a fire broke out...
Sakes alive, Mr. Barton! The roof's afire!
Well, don't stand there gawking. Run to the river and get a bucket of water.
All right.
Better get two.
The council will please come to order. We cannot have this constant bickering. 'Tis plain as the nose on your face. We have to outlaw these wooden chimneys. 27 fires in a fortnight.
My dear Mayor Stuyvesant, what concern is this of ours?
But 27 fires.
There's plenty of water. There's water all around.
But there will not be if this keeps up. We will be draining the ocean dry. Just because you own some trees and sell wood for chimneys...
It's no concern of yours, Mayor Stuyvesant, what I do. And if it's wooden chimneys they want...
The mayor, and I say...
If the mayor is going to start saying what wood will be used for, I suggest he look at his own leg. What if a fire starts there?
But Mayor Stuyvesant, wooden leg and all, had his way. Not only a ban on wooden chimneys, but...
I hereby appoint Mr. Barden, Mr. Gorman, Mr. Bockfelt, and Mr. Dunderflag as watchful fire wardens. They will see that the ban on wooden chimneys is enforced and will be empowered to inspect all hearths and firesides to see that no flames endanger dwellings.
Get out of here! I won't have you rummaging around my house.
Now you look here. I'm a watchful fire warden.
I don't care what you are. You won't be coming around my house again, or I'll set the dogs on you.
But I'm supposed to...
The watchful fire wardens found their popularity decreasing and their position quite unenviable. So nothing was done about fires until one winter night in 1657, when a log rolled out of a fireplace. In the most fashionable home in the colony, the rugs were afire, the draperies aflame.
Look, Baxter's house is afire.
Don't stand there staring. Get a bucket.
A bucket. The bucket.
Somebody fetch a bucket.
Ain't you got no buckets, Mr. Baxter?
Oh, I can't find one. I don't know what the servant did with them. Hasn't anybody got a bucket?
Seemed to be right scarce. Anybody got a bucket?
The site of the most palatial home in the colony burned to ashes finally aroused the citizens of New Amsterdam.
Each home shall be taxed 1 beaver or 8 guilders for the purpose of providing hooks and ladders and 250 leather fire buckets.
Here you are, gentlemen, the finest leather buckets we cobblers can make.
Good, good. There'll be 50 of them at Daniel's Inn, and 5 at Mr. Baxter's home, 5 at Mr. Gruller's. Oh, yes, 50 of them at City Hall. All right, now, boys, each of us in town will take his turn patrolling the streets for an hour. Now, an hour isn't much time. And if you so much as see a spark, you immediately shake the rattle like this. And when any of us hear that rattle, why, grab up what buckets you can and come a-running.
When New Amsterdam became New York, there were changes in firefighting also. The rattles and the buckets were still maintained, but every household was compelled by law to own a bucket. When the fire was sighted and the rattle sounded, each citizen ran to the window and threw the fire bucket out into the street. Members of the guards gathered them up and hurried off to the blaze. And men and women formed 2 lines between the fire and the nearest well, with 1 line passing along the full buckets and another returning the empty. And then in 1731 came an Englishman named Richard Newsham.
Fantastic, eh?
What?
Newsham's machine. It pumps water, you know.
I've heard about it.
Have you noticed the new...
For fires, that is. Yes, so they tell me.
Have you seen the new material that Altmaier has?
Strangest contraption. You pour the water into the top, and it has handles on the side. You pump it, like this, sort of.
I've heard all about it. I was asking you if
it spurts the water right out of it wherever you want it to go. What do you think of that now, eh?
I don't know about you, but... Frankly, I
I'm tired of it.
Oh.
Two of Newsham's machines were brought to America and were soon given an opportunity to prove themselves.
Yes, sir. If it hadn't been for them two fire engines, we'd really be in the soup. Jim Edwards' house caught fire, but with them two engines, we got it put out in a jiffy. Put it out before it did more than burn down Jim's house and the two next door.
With fire engines like these, companies were formed. Volunteer societies that popped up all over New York. And when the fire bell sounded, men dropped whatever they were doing, rushed to their firehouses, donned their leather hats, and dragged their pet fire engines through the streets. They even christened their engines with such names as Old Wreath of Roses, Lady Washington, Red Rover. And before long, rivalries developed, which didn't hurt the fires much at all.
Now listen, Farnley, and you other boys. The Polk Street boys beat us to the last three fires, and I don't like the joshing folks are giving us.
Me neither, Chief. None of us do. Well, what can we do?
Easy. See them barrels? We'll keep them right here at the firehouse. Now, as soon as the bell rings, you fellas grab them and scamper off to the fire while the rest of us pull the wagon.
Well, I don't see what good a barrel is going to do if we can't get our engine there first.
Don't you see, you consarned fool? You get there and put the barrel over the fire hydrant. That way, whoever gets there first can't get to the water until we get our engine there.
Unfortunately, the fires didn't wait till the fistfight subsided. And while many fire companies turned to horsepower to pull the heavy engines, more than a few volunteer laddies of the old days refused to give up the honor of pulling them by manpower. But scientific progress did not wait on personal honor or sentiment. Early in the 19th century, steam was used to operate a fire pump, and vehicles were built with both pump and boiler mounted on a wagon. By the time of the Great Chicago Fire, most of the companies used steam fire engines. Another great contribution to firefighting was the flexible hose, which permitted the fighters to park the engine far enough from the blaze to keep it from burning too. And a still later development was the suction hose. With motorized fire engines, science progressed even further and developed new methods of pumping.
The rotary-type gear is a positive action pump which will draw water from a depth of 20 to 25 feet without being primed. Another type, the centrifugal pump, is also used. And piston pumps are very satisfactory under some conditions.
But firefighters work with more than water. From the chemistry laboratories come new methods.
Where water is scarce, soda acid engines can be used. Now, these are vessels with a solution of bicarbonate of soda dissolved in water, along with a separate cylinder of sulfuric acid. The sulfuric acid is discharged into the bicarbonate of soda solution. This reaction forms carbonic acid under pressure, which forces the solution through the hose.
And foam chemical engines,
which operate much as the soda acid engines, except that the acid ingredient is a solution of aluminum sulfate dissolved in water. To this, a stabilizing solution is added to make the bubbles and foam tougher. Now, this foam adheres to any burning surface, even on a vertical wall or to a ceiling. Also, it can float on any inflammable liquid.
Fight against fire goes on. And though flames still consume millions of dollars a year, sending life and property up in smoke, man is winning his fight against fire. And he is doing it because scientific principles and techniques have replaced the crude firefighting methods of early America to make a never-ending adventure in research. That's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Programs are broadcast to armed forces personnel overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Join us again next week for another transcribed story of science on Adventures in Research.
Hey, where do you live now, Flo?
I live in Idaho.
And what do you eat now, Flo?
Eat? I eat Jell-O.
Jell-O in those six delicious flavors. Strawberry, raspberry, cherry, orange, lemon, and lime.
Jell-O, 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 Jell-O. J-E-L-L-O.
Be sure to listen next week when our guest will be Bing Crosby. Until next Thursday, good night and good luck from the makers of Maxwell House, America's number one preferred brand of coffee.
Boy, what a moment this is, fans. I know that you can feel the tenseness that we feel here in New York. As the National League up for the last time with 7 minutes left to play, the deadline before the blackout in New York, Mayor LaGuardia was very kind to set aside the time to give baseball more time tonight. You know, this game was supposed to end at 9:10, but there was an unavoidable delay in starting, and so Mayor LaGuardia very graciously gave baseball a little longer time, right up until the actual deadline of the blackout, which is 9:30. He's getting all set again. Here's the pitch. There's a swing, and there's a foul that the first baseman may have a chance on. He's going back, and it's going into the stands. A foul ball, and it's 2-2 on Little Mel. Now Bertie Tebbets gets a new baseball from Bill McGowan. Tosses that ball out there. Well, the American League, as you know, scored their 3 runs in the first inning on a home run, a double and another home run, and the National League scored their run in the 8th inning on a pinch home run by Mickey Owen. Now he's getting all set again. It's 2-2 on up. Here it comes. It's a swing and a foul tip, and it got away from Tebbets, and he's going to get another swing. Looks like Bertie was hurt with that foul. Tebbets went down on one knee, but he's getting up now and seems to be okay. Well, it's been a wonderful sight here in New York tonight. These fans that have jammed into these stands have really enjoyed it, and Jim and Mel and I have really seen a grand ball game. We hope that you've enjoyed it on the radio. Here comes the next pitch, and Ott hits a pop-up right in front of the plate. The catcher, Tebbets, is down the line just a few feet and takes that ball 20 feet down the line toward third and 1 foot inside the line, a fair ball, and Ott is out. So, fans, two more now, and the ball game will be over. Now the next man to come up, a left-handed hitter, is Eno Slaughter of the St. Louis Cardinals, a great ball player. This fella can run, he can field, he can hit, and he loves to play ball. There's 5 minutes left here in New York. It's getting all set now. There's the windup, and here comes the next pitch. And there's a swing and a foul. One strike. American League 3 and the National League 1. That's the setup. Nobody on and one gone in the last half of the ninth. Here comes the pitch, and there is a foul. It's right up here to the right, just to the right of our booth. Catcher Tebbets gets another new ball and fires it right out there to Benton. Country Slaughter batting for the National League with nobody on and one gone. Benton is all set. Here comes the next pitch, and Slaughter takes one in the dirt, a ball. Ball one and strike two for Eno. He's up in there batting left-handed, a red nine in the back of his white uniform. American League infielders keep up a constant stream of chatter. Here comes the pitch, and there is another ball. He almost hit him in the leg. He was going to go for that one. It was a sinker, and he started to go for it, but he pulled his bat in time, and the umpire calls it a ball. The outfield of Williams, DiMaggio, and Henrik that's gone all the way is playing Slaughter straight away. Just about 4 minutes left. They'll get their bats all right. He He's getting all set again. Here comes the next pitch, and there's a swing and a hopper foul to the right of the plate. Slaughter starts down the first baseline, but the umpire, Bill McGowan, yells foul. He tells Bertie Tebbets to throw that ball away, flips him a new ball, and the American Leaguers peg it around. The next man to come up after Slaughter will be Ernie Lombardi. Bill McGowan is getting a new supply of baseballs now in his blue serge suit. Al Benton is the second American League pitcher tonight. Chandler started. He's getting all set again. Here comes the next one to Slaughter. Slaughter swings. There's a long fly ball to dead center, but DiMaggio is out there backing up. He caught it, and there's two gone. Country Slaughter hit one a mile that time towards center field, but Joe DiMaggio raced back about 35 or 40 feet and pulled it down, and there's two gone. And now, friends, here comes Ernie Lombardi, the last hope of the National League. Here's Ernie Lombardi. Here's the first pitch. There's a strike. It's over the outside corner. Two out and nobody on in the last half of the ninth inning. American League 3-1. Here comes the next pitch to Lam. Lam swings and misses. A change of pace pitch in around his knees, and the pitcher made him look bad on it. It's two strikes on Lombardi. There's two out. One more out and the ball game is over, and the American League will play the service team in Cleveland tomorrow night. Now Al Benton is all set again. Here comes the next pitch. He hits a high fly ball to right field. Looks like it's all over. Tommy Hendrick is in under the ball, and he caught it. The game is over, and the American League defeats the National League in New York in the 10th annual All-Star Game. And so, fans, the American League will play the National League, will play the All-Star team in Cleveland tomorrow night. And here are the totals. The American League, 3 runs, 7 hits, and no errors. The National League, 1 run, 6 hits, and 1 error. The winning pitcher in the ball game is Chandler, and the losing pitcher is Martin Cooper. I want to give my colleagues who work with on the broadcast with me tonight just a chance to say goodbye. We're going to have to get off in a hurry, and here's Mel Allen.
It was swell working this game with Bob Elson and Jimmy Britt. It was a beautiful ball game to watch. A lot of swell pitching. Only one half inning, which was any great deal of offensive fireworks. In the first inning, when Lou Budrow homered and Rudy York homered with Tommy Hendrick on base, who had doubled prior to York's homer. It was really a swell ball game to watch. Wish you were all here. All right, here's Jimmy Britt.
The fact that this game had a blackout deadline to make added to the suspense and drama of the final innings. It was an all-star game worth remembering, and the American League is going to give Uncle Sam Service 9 in Cleveland tomorrow night a real battle.
Well, thank you very much, Jim and Mel. It's been a real pleasure to work with you tonight. I'm looking forward to tomorrow night with working with Wade Hoyt and Jack Rennie over at Cleveland, when Mutual will bring you an exclusive coverage again of the great All-Star Game at Cleveland at the big Municipal Stadium. The players are getting off the field. The American League players are shaking hands with each other, and so are the National League players as they go off the field. And the final score again is the American League 3, the National League 1. The winning pitcher is Chandler, and the losing pitcher is Cooper. And now this is Bob Elson saying good night from the Polo Grounds in New York City. We return you to our New York studios.
You are listening to the Golden Age of Radio in the final moments of the 1942 Major League Baseball All-Star Game on July 6, 1942. We also heard an episode of Adventures in Research featuring narrator Paul Shannon, first broadcast on radio on February 9, 1943. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s, when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY, at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Here's an episode of Crime Classics and the true story of the checkered life and the sudden death of James Fisk, starring Lou Merrill as narrator Thomas Highland, and also featuring William Johnstone, Mary Jane Croft, and Steve Roberts, as WMKY presents The Golden Age of Radio.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland. I'm going to tell you another true crime story. Listen. The man who just fell down the stairs is Colonel James Fisk, Jr. Although the Colonel is a man given to the consumption of dozens of Blue Point oysters and bottles of heady wine at a sitting, his friends were given to pointing him out as a man inordinately steady on his feet. So why did he tumble down the stairs? And in New York's Grand Central Hotel, no less, where stair tumbling was frowned upon, the Colonel didn't slip. He wasn't pushed. He was shot. The sudden presence of two bullets in him had upset his equilibrium. The man who's running away is the man who just shot the Colonel. His name, Edward S. Stokes. Until recently, the Colonel's very dear friend. There he goes. And tonight, my report to you on the checkered life and sudden death of Colonel James Fisk, Jr. Crime Classics. A series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. And now once again, Thomas Highland. Colonel Fisk lay at the bottom of the stairs a few minutes before 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, January the 6th, 1872. He was dying. His life was coming to an end. And he would be sorely missed by his family, Mrs. Fisk and the children, and by his intimates, among whom were Jay Gould, Boss Tweed, and the heavier stockholders of the day. A man dying, and I know the precise instant when his dying began. It started some months ago in a rather ornate house in Washington Square. Two women were talking, and the younger one said,
"Annie, how can I meet Colonel Fisk?"
That was the instant. And the older one said,
"Oh, dearie, dearie, dearie."
But the younger one was not young enough to take dearie for an answer.
"I mean it, Annie. I want to meet him. He's so wealthy, isn't he? And all I have is a black and white silk dress and an empty purse. So very empty, dear Annie." "Oh, often's in the rain, and empty purses sadden me so, dear Josie." "And I've heard he's coming here tonight to visit with you." "The dear Colonel says I set such a good table." "Dear Josie."
"Yes?"
"Walk over there to that cabinet, dear Josie. In the very bottom drawer, you will find two candlesticks given to me by the minister from Egypt. Get them." "Yes. They are heavy, aren't they? Now put them on the table. And light them. Good. Now blow them out, gently.
Well, Annie?"
"Dear Josie, will you join the dear Colonel and me for dinner tonight?"
"So nice of you to ask. I'd be delighted, dear Annie."
So it was that Colonel Fisk and Josie Mansfield met. It was a highly successful meeting.
"I kiss your hand, Josie."
"You're a very sweet man."
"Isn't she a dear?"
"So lovely."
"And so poor."
"So sad."
The Colonel was a man easily touched. And this was the era for young widows, beautiful and penniless. It was the era for weeping at the mere thought of such a situation. It was a decade of compassion and champagne. And this night, The meeting night was one of the most poignant of the decade.
Tomorrow, Josie, a jewel to lie against the throat.
Oh, Colonel.
My carriage will call for you at noon and bring you to me.
And where will you be?
At Tiffany's.
The necklace counter?
Of course, my dear. More wine? Diamonds become you.
Oh, Colonel. Oh, Colonel.
Look at it, dear. Do you like it?
It's very nice.
And it's all yours.
Oh, thank you. I've always wanted a home of my own. And servants of my own?
Six.
Kiss me, Colonel.
Good evening, Colonel.
Evening, Quimby. This is Mr. Stokes.
May I take your cane, sir?
Thank you, Quimby.
The mistress is in the drawing room. She's waiting for you.
This way, Stokes.
Hello, Colonel. And you must be the Colonel's best friend, Mr. Stokes.
I hope this is no imposition, ma'am.
Preparing dinner? Certainly not. I just sat here all day, listening to the new present the Colonel sent me, while the servants made ready.
Do you like the new music box, my dear?
It reminds me of you when you're away from me.
Such a pretty speech. How fortunate you are, Colonel.
Oh, wait till you taste her pheasant a la Esther.
I can hardly wait.
Will you two excuse me for a moment?
Where are you going, Colonel?
I left a small package for you out in the carriage, my dear.
Of course, we'll excuse you. So, you're Mr. Stokes.
So you're Josie.
I must say he was right. You are elegant.
He was right. You are very lovely.
You're younger than he told me.
And you're...
What?
You are.
Will you help me light the candles?
Josie.
Will you help me with the fireplace?
Josie.
The music box is run down. Will you...
Josie.
You won't help me with anything. You're wicked.
Yes, I am.
You're very wicked.
At the time Josie whispered this tender criticism, Mr. Edward Stokes was 5 feet 9 inches high. His head was covered with glossy curls, his complexion clear, his features regular, and his eyes dark blue. He was dressed in the height of fashion, and his diamond studs gleamed brilliantly. And after the Colonel returned with a forgotten package...
Oh, a ruby pendant! Thank you, Colonel.
You're very welcome.
And after the wine was drunk and venison devoured, and the fingers dipped in the lemon water, after that evening of old friends and new, after that, there was a new day. And there was this.
Good morning, Mr. Stokes.
Good morning, Quimby.
The mistress is in the sitting room. She's waiting for you.
Thank you, my man. Josie.
Edward. Awake, Edward. I was out this morning early shopping. Here, I bought something for you. Open it.
Josie, a pearl stick pin. There was no need for you to...
Oh, yes, there was. Now be quiet.
Several other scenes between these wild, storm-tossed lovers you might care to eavesdrop upon, since they'll give you a better understanding of the currents sweeping these two upon violent shores, like this one.
The best champagne in New York. Now take off your little shoe. Here, use my mallet, dear. This croquet has brought the pink to your cheeks. Make your shot.
As is always the case in skullduggery of this sort, there is an in the meanwhile. So, in the meanwhile, in the Park Avenue home of Colonel James Fisk, Jr., the Colonel and his lady, the children have been tucked away for the night, the servants snug in their quarters, as were the animals. A quiet hour, an hour for a man and his wife, and for family discussion.
You fool! You cheat!
Dear, the children, you'll awaken them.
A woman like that.
Have you no compassion in your heart? She's a widow.
Ha, ha.
Alone in the world. I am but her advisor.
Ha, ha. Now that's all you are.
What are you talking about?
What all of New York is saying.
And that is?
Ha, ha.
And that is?
The most concerned is the last to know.
Know what?
Your precious widow and Edward Stokes.
What?
Ha, ha, Colonel. Now you know what I've been through. The aggravation, the shame, the heartache, the sorrow, the unrequited love.
I'm sorry, Colonel. It's so late at night.
Quimby, where is...
The mistress is in her boudoir.
Go awaken her.
Who is it, Quimby?
It's not Mr. Stokes, ma'am.
Why, good evening, Colonel.
What's this I hear about you and that scamp, Edward Stokes?
Why, what have you heard?
That you and he...
Who told you that?
My wife.
You'd better go back to her, Colonel.
Then it's true.
I love him very much.
Josie.
Go back to your wife.
I warn you.
You warn me? You, Colonel?
Listen to me. I'll ruin you.
Please. Go home.
You and Edward Stokes. Mark my word. I'll ruin the both of you. My promise to you, if it takes the rest of my life.
The colonel left. The colonel was driven to his club, where the colonel spent the night. And the next morning, early, the colonel began the final week of his life. You are listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Highland, and his report to you on the checkered life and sudden death of Colonel James Fisk, Jr. I'd like to set the coordinates for you again. Take a reading of exactly where we are in time and space. The year is 1872. The place is New York City. Now, 1872 was a vintage year for pearls in the bottom of champagne glasses, of fatted railroad stocks, and the diamond harvest was spectacular. The term rags to riches was coined on a day in this year when a raggedy sewing machine girl was summoned from her chores, taken by the hand, dressed in silk, then released into a gilded cage. New York City at this time was a center for many similar dramas, one of which we're concerning ourselves with. Colonel James Fisk, Jr. had compassion for a widow named Josie Mansfield. Josie Mansfield had compassion for the colonel's friend, Edward Stokes. The colonel, upon hearing of this arrangement, immediately went into action, in a colonel-like manner.
Your Honor, I want to swear out a warrant for the arrest of Edward S. Stokes for embezzlement.
Why, certainly, Colonel. We'll have the culprit in jail in no time at all.
Inside with you, Mr. Stokes.
Taylor.
Yes, sir, Mr. Stokes.
Do you have the list?
Yes, sir. Your living room furniture, the portraits, and the bed. I'll have them here in no time at all.
Edward Stokes was a model prisoner for 2 days. He was then released when the charge against him was dropped. Not to be outdone, he went into action in a manner which gained the plaudits of his cronies.
Your Honor, I want to swear out a warrant for the arrest of Colonel James Fisk, Jr. for false imprisonment.
Why, certainly, Mr. Stokes. We'll have the culprit in jail in no time at all.
Jailer?
Yes, sir, Colonel. The living room furniture, your easy chair in the library, and the bed. I'll have them here in no time at all.
War of nerves, tactics, and strategies, and reprisals. And the real victors, the gatherers of the loot, the lawyers. So the Colonel and Mr. Stokes called a truce, waved white napkins at each other across a gleaming table at Delmonico's.
Stokes, I think we both acted like children.
I agree with you, Colonel.
Let me fill your glass. Yeah. A toast. To a friendship.
Our friendship, Colonel.
Enough of jails and lawyers and arguments. Life is too short.
I'll drink to that, too. Colonel?
And we can settle our affairs like men.
I'll drink to that, too.
No, wait. Let's settle our affairs first.
Delighted.
There is only one thing which stands in our way.
Obviously.
Josie Mansfield.
You're right.
Stokes, you're not ever to see her again.
Colonel?
You agree?
Colonel, you're a fat, stupid fool.
I accept that. But you're never to see Josie Mansfield again.
Josie told me that if I saw you, I was to tell you are a fat, stupid fool. And you are.
I warned you once, Stokes. I'm not going to warn you again.
Then I'll warn you. If you make any trouble, Colonel, you won't live to enjoy it. My promise to you.
Good evening, Mr. Stokes. The mistress is in the parlor.
Josie, wake up.
Oh, Edward. How nice, Edward.
Dearest, listen. It's important. Are you awake?
Well, of course, I just drowsed off. I was reading, waiting for you, and now you're here.
Josie, listen. It's about Colonel Fisk.
Oh, please don't talk about him. Not now.
He's ruined me.
What are you talking about?
I'm a pauper.
You? Why, you're one of the wealthiest young men in
the world. No, not now. I don't have a penny.
What happened?
The stocks I had, all my assets.
Well?
The colonel forced down the value of the Erie Railroad stocks, wiped me out.
Oh, Edward, I'm so sorry.
Josie.
Yes?
I'm poor now. Do you want me to leave? Never come back?
Darling Edward. Darling, dearest Edward.
Josie.
We'll beat him. We'll destroy the colonel, you and I together.
That's impossible. He's too powerful.
He's a weakling.
What?
I can prove he's a weakling. He writes letters.
Letters?
I saved them. And that's not all.
What do you mean?
Dealings he's had. Dishonest business dealings. Would you like to look at them?
Dearest Josie, I love you so much. So that's why I thought it more discreet to hire a cab, Colonel. Surely you understand.
I must tell you, Stokes, when I agreed to meet you, to ride with you in a hired hack at night...
I explained the necessity of secrecy, Colonel.
As indeed you did not. You merely said secrecy. That is why I must tell you I am confused. Have you made another decision about Josie?
A tentative decision, Colonel.
Tentative?
Yes, it depends on you.
Oh?
I need money.
I know.
Badly.
I know.
Colonel?
Yes?
You love Josie very much, don't you?
I understand you now, Stokes.
I thought you would.
Do you want me to reimburse you for the money you've lost?
$250,000.
I know. In return for which, you'll give up Josie.
That's right.
I'm sure there must be a name for you, Mr. Stokes.
I'm sure of it.
I had an experience last night. I had dinner at home with my wife. The children were with us. After dinner, I played on the floor with my children. I heard them laugh. I heard my wife laugh, too. And I laughed, too. And there was no other meaning behind my laughter except enjoyment of my family.
Very touching.
And rewarding.
Then you're not interested in my proposal.
I'll get off at the next corner, Mr. Stokes. Tell the driver.
Of course. Next corner, cabby.
Well, Mr. Stokes, give my regards to Josie. Tell her I'm truly sorry for what's going to become of her. Goodbye, Mr. Stokes.
Colonel, wait.
I'm sorry, we have nothing else to talk about.
Except the letters.
What letters?
You have a rich way with words, Colonel. I congratulate you.
I don't understand.
Oh, of course you do. The letters you wrote to Josie.
I see.
All of them.
I see.
They could ruin you.
Perhaps.
I remember one of the letters opened with, "Dearest Josie, my poor little widow, your sad tears still on my shoulders."
$10,000.
And another, "Dear Josie, this morning I was at Tammany Hall, and with Boss Tweed, arrangements were made to relieve the city."
$10,000.
$250,000 for the letters, Colonel.
$10,000, or you may publish them or do what you want with them.
Surely you're not serious.
Good night, Mr. Stokes.
$10,000.
Bring your letters to me tomorrow, and you shall get your money. Good night.
An old almanac I have occasion to call on now and then says that Saturday, the 6th of January, in the year 1872, is the 66th anniversary of the Volunteer Fire Department of Roanoke, Virginia. Also, it predicts the day will be cold and clear with high westerly winds. So, we'll make an assumption. On a cold, clear Saturday morning, buffeted by the high westerly winds, Mr. Edward Stokes made his way to the Wall Street office of Colonel Fisk. Here he received more coldness and $10,000. Here he deposited with the colonel a stack of letters, wrapped in blue ribbon and sachet. Then Edward Stokes called on Josie Mansfield. He told her of the transaction. We must imagine that Josie's reaction went something like this.
You idiot! You bumbling, spineless idiot!
But Josie...
I should have known better than to trust you with those letters.
But $10,000 is better than nothing.
If you'd had the courage...
He told me $10,000 or nothing.
If you'd had the courage, he would have given you everything he owned. Why, the mere possession of the letter dated June 16th, 1871, would have been a fortune 10 times the amount you got.
But...
But what?
You have your jewels, this house. Surely you must be worth nearly $1 million yourself.
I love you, dear Edward, but that's my money. You'll just have... What is it, Quimby?
Miss Annie Wood wishes to speak with you.
Tell her I'm busy.
She said it's extremely urgent.
Extremely urgent.
Hello, Annie.
Josie, dear Josie, and dear Mr. Stokes.
Hello.
The judge came to see me for lunch a little while ago.
Judge? What are you talking about?
Judge Tripler.
Well, I don't see.
He just come from court. He just signed a warrant.
Yes?
For the arrest of dear Mr. Stokes on the charge of blackmail.
Colonel Fisk?
Yes. The dear judge told me that the colonel asked him to sign such a warrant. Josie?
Yes?
We'll be seeing each other more often, won't we, dear Josie?
Publication of the time. I quote, "The next that was seen of Edward Stokes, as far as is known, was at a few minutes before 4 o'clock, when he was walking carelessly up and down the main corridor of the Grand Central Hotel on the parlor floor. This corridor is one story above the street, is parallel with Broadway, and at its northern end is reached by a staircase from the street. Passing and repassing the head of the staircase, Stokes glanced furtively down the stairs. It was nearly 4 o'clock when Colonel James Fisk, Jr. drove up in a carriage to the door. Stepping out of his carriage and walking briskly across the pavement, he passed through the outer door of the hotel. When he had done so, he was heard to inquire for a certain Annette Latour. He was told she was in and started up the stairs.
Good afternoon, Colonel.
Stokes, don't!
You'll ruin me.
For the love of heaven, someone help me!
Edward Stokes was restrained a block away. The colonel didn't die immediately. He was lifted by three bellhops and taken to chambers supplied by the management. Doctors were called, and the colonel joked with them, as he joked with his many friends who came to visit him. He joked with everybody. The next day, in the middle of a joke, he died. Thomas Stokes pleaded self-defense. He was convicted of manslaughter in the third degree. Josie Mansfield spent her remaining days with her aunt, Miss Annie Wood.
And here again is Thomas Highland.
Next week, Long Melford in the county of Suffolk in England. The year, 1739. My report to you will be on the shrapneled body of Charles Drew, Sr. Thank you. Good night.
James Fisk, Jr., tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. James Fisk, Jr. was played by William Johnstone. Featured in the cast were Mary Jane Croft, Martha Wentworth, Steve Roberts, Harry Bartell, Paula Winslow, and Charles Calvert. Bob Lamond speaking.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY with an episode of Crime Classics, The Checkered Life and Sudden Death of James Fisk, starring Lou Merrill as narrator Thomas Highland, and also featuring William Johnstone, Mary Jane Croft, and Steve Roberts. This has been the Golden Age of Radio and classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.